Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role has the occult played in the evolution of our national values? Schoolbook histories of American religious tolerance tend to center around the Founding Fathers' embrace of Judeo-Christian values and resistance to the establishment of a national faith. But the protections built into our Constitution against religious oppression also made this an attractive place for people keen to experiment with the occult. And my guest today has found ample evidence that Americans have done so for hundreds of years, and in doing so have had a significant and often positive impact on the development of our values. Mitch Horowitz is editor-in-chief of Tarcher Penguin Publishing. His new book is called Occult in America, The Secret History of How Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. Mitch, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I think we need to start here by talking about this word occult. It is, for many people, almost synonymous with a sort of deliberate evil. But in fact, the definition is a lot more neutral than the connotation.
That's right. It comes from the Latin word occultus, which means secret or obscure. And that word began to get used during the Renaissance when there was a new flowering of discovery of old religious philosophies, philosophies that went back to ancient Egypt and Greece and Rome, and a lot of these things had been lost during the Dark Ages. And occultism regards itself classically as a religious or spiritual tradition whose teachings are not necessarily withheld, but they require some work to get at. They're not necessarily readily available. And it doesn't attach itself to any one particular religion or doctrine. I mean, you find occult ideas within Judaism, within Christianity. You find a mystical wing of Islam, but occultism has always maintained that spiritual understanding is available without belonging to any one religion. So it's often run askance of mainstream religion and attracted suspicion and even hostility.
And in some cases, occult practice has been as much about our connection to the natural world as to the supernatural world.
Absolutely. You know, in late antiquity, the early Christian church was in a great struggle with the pagan religions. And these were religions that were very heavily based in nature, in seasons, in astrology, in worship of the natural world or the forces that run through it. And eventually, as Christianity came to hold dominance in the Western world, it classified some of the practitioners of the old religions as followers of Satanism or black magic. Those were really the first time those terms were used in Western history, and they were used as epithets, and they were used in ways that the pagan powers had never viewed themselves or understood themselves. I have no doubt if this great thought battle had gone in the other direction, the pagan religious powers would have done the same thing to the Christians. It was just a battle of ideas, and those who were the losers in that battle were classified as the followers of something evil.
So what made early America such a haven for people who were interested in occult ideas?
It was interesting. You know, the religious tolerance in this nation really predates our Constitution. In fact, our Constitution is built on a tradition of tolerance, in a sense, that was already developing in America generations before the Declaration of the Republic. In the mid-1600s, Europe, particularly Central Europe, was torn apart by the 30 Years' War. That was basically a war that pitted Catholic armies against Protestant armies. And there was a lot of religious liberalism in Europe. There were many religious and occult experiments coming out of the Renaissance. That started to come to an end, at least in Central Europe, in the mid-1600s. And you had regions of Central Germany, the Rhine Valley, the areas around Prague and Bohemia. They were just devastated. So there were lots of religiously liberal folk in those areas who had an interest in esoteric and occult philosophies. And they suddenly found themselves in a world that had been torn apart. They began to trickle across the Atlantic to the American colonies. The American colonies very early on had developed a reputation for religious liberalism. William Penn had founded the city of Philadelphia, or the city of brotherly love, as a place where he felt different religious faiths could exist side by side. So in Philadelphia, you had Quakers and Mennonites and radical offshoots of the Lutheran Church, all living and functioning together. And so soon enough, there were little mystical colonies and groups sprouting up around Philadelphia and the Pennsylvania countryside. And these places, some were short-lived, some endured for a few generations. They were successful in the sense that people were able to gather into these little religious clusters without harassment. People came to visit these places, and it started to accustom early Americans to the idea of religious experiment. So by by the year 1774, this pattern was so well set that you had a group of radical Christians who were being persecuted in Manchester, England. They were called the Shaking Quakers. They decided they had to leave Europe. They came immediately to New York City. And by the year 1776, they had scraped together enough money to found a colony up in Albany, New York, and they were known as the Shakers. And their villages spread into New England and as far south as Kentucky. So you had this pattern set where people were seeking a safe harbor for radical religious beliefs in the American colonies.
Well, the Shakers point to an interesting thread that runs really throughout the book, which is how often in our country's history people have sort of, at least from their own perspective, successfully combined occult ideas with much more traditional religious ideas.
Yes, it's very interesting, and it's really been a trait of religious experiment in this country. Again and again in our history, you find people who have supernatural ideas, but also still belong to the Christian church of their youth, or they still practice the Christian moral outlook of their youth. The first female religious leader in this country was a woman named Jemima Wilkinson, and she grew up on a Quaker farm in Rhode Island around the time of the Revolutionary War. There were two different waves sweeping the area at that time. One was the Great Awakening, and Jemima converted to a very fervent brand of baptism. And the other wave was a physical one. It was typhus fever, and Jemima was struck with typhus fever in October of 1776. She went to her bed, and she slipped in and out of a coma for several days, and her family thought for certain she was a goner. And then one day, she just sprung up from the bed with this renewed burst of energy, still kind of skinny and emaciated from her fever and her illness. But her cheeks were rosy red, and she told her astonished Quaker family that the girl they knew as Jemima was now dead, and that the being standing before them was a spirit channel called the Public Universal Friend. And she claimed to be reborn as a channel or an avatar of the divine spirit. And so the Public Universal Friend began to travel around New England, New York State, Philadelphia, preaching and giving homilies. And most of what she dispensed was just a kind of warmed-over Quakerism. She would talk about the need to try to love your neighbor, the golden rule, the need to try to be punctual, you know, just some very ordinary domestic and Sunday school forms of advice. She still had a very Christian tone, but her claims about herself were fantastic and supernatural. And people were astonished by her because it was the first time that most anyone had seen a woman deliver a sermon or a homily in public. There was something reassuringly Christian about her message, but Americans were very excited that they could be experiencing a divine dispensation right here and now in the present. And the fact that it was coming out of the mouth of this supernatural figure, this spirit channel, was very arousing and exciting to people. But neither she nor her followers ever saw themselves as anything other than Christian.
Well, the other interesting thing about the universal public friend is that, as you mentioned, she was really the first woman preacher in this country's history.
Right.
Can you talk about why the occult has more often been associated with sort of progressive ideas about the role of women than traditional faiths of their time?
It's very interesting. The occult really seemed to crack open doorways in this country. And you see a pattern from the universal friend going forward into the 19th century, where you had the rise of a movement in America called spiritualism, which involved forming into seances and talking to the dead and listening for spirit raps and things like that. And this movement called spiritualism began, again, in upstate New York, which was a very fertile place for new religions in the early to mid-19th century. Spiritualism began in upstate New York in 1848, the first year, by the way, is the first women's rights conference at Seneca Falls. And there were these two teenage girls living in a little log cabin outside of Rochester, New York. And there were these weird bangs and sounds throughout the cabin. And these girls told their Methodist parents that these were spirit raps and that they could contact the spirits and communicate with them through these bangs and rappings and so forth. And all these different respected figures in society, from clergy to newspaper editor Horace Greeley to a New York State Supreme Court justice, came to this little cabin and they verified what the girls were saying. And they said, well, you know, gosh, we've investigated this, and this seems to be true. And people were just enthralled. I think people were very excited by the idea that if these two teenage girls could be contacting the spirit world, maybe we all could. It tapped into this kind of do-it-yourself spirit in America, which colors so many of our attitudes, including our religious attitudes. And as it happens, most of the spirit mediums of the mid-19th century were women. And it really became the first time in modern history that women were able to openly and routinely serve in roles of religious leadership. And it was this very enthralling experience, and it attracted lots of women who had ambitions to be public figures but had no other forum for it. And suddenly you found the suffragette movement and the spiritualist movement growing together. They became like branches growing out of the same tree. And in the mid-19th century, you could not find a suffragette activist who hadn't spent some time at the seance table, and vice versa. Most trance mediums were active within the suffragist movement. It just represented this dramatic, unexpected opening for women, and it figured into this pattern of progressive politics and esoteric spirituality growing up together in America.
Of course, Mitch, things did not go nearly as well for women in Salem during the time of the witch trials. What do you think accounts for the vastly different understanding that people had of the occult at that point?
Well, you know, Salem occurred in the mid 1690s, and it was this spasm of mob violence. There were a lot of strange difficulties going on at Salem, and the story of Salem is really the story of mob violence, which is always a very perplexing and confusing one. The thing I would say about Salem, without in any way wanting to minimize the tragedy of what happened there, because people were tortured there, people were killed there. The killings there went on for several years. It was a grisly situation. It was also an exceptional situation. There were other instances of mob violence in America, sometimes directed at unusual religious figures like Mother Ann Lee, the leader of the Shakers. But to a very great extent, Salem was an exception. It was an anomaly in this country. In Europe, for example, you had a witch craze that went on for literally centuries. And even as late as 1798, so far along into the Age of Reason that people had stopped using the term, in a sense. The Age of Reason was triumphant everywhere. In 1798, in Switzerland, a rural housemaid was tortured and beheaded on charges of being a witch, when things like that weren't supposed to happen anymore. And there were other instances that went on even later than that in Poland. So in America, Salem was a nightmare, but it was an anomaly. It was an exception. Many of these religious communities that formed and intentionally considered themselves mystical or cult were able to get by without harassment.
Can you talk about the connection that the abolitionist leader Frederick Douglass had to the occult?
It was really fascinating. There was an African-American system of magic in this country called hoodoo, and it still exists and is still practiced today. It's very much an American spiritual tradition that was brought to America on slave ships. It was a magical system, is a magical system, that African slaves created, abided by, lived within, and they were trying to hang on to some of the old systems of Africa while also trying to find their way to a new religious understanding in a very tough, brutal environment that they had been forced into. And it's a magical system that involves using ordinary household objects like pins and needles, perfumes, animal parts, soaps, herbs, roots, all of which are believed to have some kind of magical power. It's a marriage of African ideas and American ideas. And it was a folk system and a religious system that in some ways became the first universal religious faith, at least in this country, because it involved everything from elements of Native American herb medicine to Jewish Kabbalah. It was just remarkable the number of things you would find within hoodoo, and still do. It's a living tradition that continues to be practiced. When Frederick Douglass was a teenager and found himself sold into the hands of a very brutal slave owner, there was a hoodoo root worker or medicine man named Sandy Jenkins who gave Douglass this magic root, as Douglass called it, and he gave him a tremendous sense of confidence at one of the most difficult periods of his life. It was a tremendously important psychological watershed for Douglass, and he writes about it in his memoirs, but we've overlooked it because we're not able to connect the pieces.
Mitch Horowitz is my guest. He's editor-in-chief of Tartar Penguin Publishing. His new book is called Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. We'll be back in just a minute. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mitch Horowitz. He is editor-in-chief of Tarcher Penguin Publishing. His new book is called Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Mary Todd Lincoln took a deep interest in spiritualism, but this was not exactly something that always earned her a great deal of respect.
That's right. Sometimes Mary Todd Lincoln's interest in spiritualism and her habit of frequenting the seance table made its way into the newspapers, and it was a tremendous embarrassment to her. Mary Todd Lincoln really, you know, her story is one that's continually marked by grief. By the time the Lincolns took up residency in the White House, she had already lost two sons to childhood diseases. And in those days, and the experience of Mary Todd Lincoln was like many other people's in this country, there was no grief counseling, there was no pastoral counseling, there was no support groups, there was no therapy, there was really no place to seek solace when a child was lost. And so many of the deaths recorded in mid-century were to childhood diseases. So she did what hundreds of thousands of mothers did, which is she sought solace at the seance table. And it's interesting because whatever was going on at the seance table, you know, whether it was fantasy, psychology, whether it was con artistry sometimes, there were lots of articulate, very capable people who described their episodes at the seance table in letters and diaries as some of the most moving experiences of their lives. And this was the case for Mary Todd Lincoln. And she introduced the idea of spiritualism to her husband, Abraham Lincoln, and there were a couple of seances apparently held in the White House during the Civil War. There was one seance in particular in which Abraham Lincoln permitted a reporter from the Boston Gazette to be present, and a lot of people wondered, why would the president have permitted a reporter to be present for this very strange activity that would seem like something of an embarrassment that you'd want to keep a secret? And the fact is, I think Lincoln scored a kind of interesting propaganda coup with this Civil War seance, because what people sometimes misunderstand today is that although spiritualism was practiced with a great deal of gravity by some people, for others it was just a parlor game. It was just a novelty. And I think that Lincoln was trying to present an image of himself to the nation as a commander-in-chief who could still sit back and relax, was not overly encumbered by wartime command, and could sample a kind of a game or a novelty that lots of other Americans were sampling. And the report in the Boston Gazette, you know, is filled with Lincoln making funny comments and teasing some of his cabinet secretaries, asking them whether they thought the military advice from the spirit world was any better than military advice among the mortals. And it was just pure Lincoln, and he seemed to be having a good time. But there are other stories of a more serious seance in the Civil War era White House in which Mary Todd Lincoln brought a teenage trance medium to meet the president, and she went into some kind of a spirit trance. And according to her reports, the spirits tried to convince Abraham Lincoln to sign the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, we have no way of proving whether this episode actually occurred, but what's interesting is that spiritualists, they had a politics, they had a progressive politics, and they wanted to be associated in some sense with the public good. They didn't want to be seen as these behind-the-scenes figures who were trying to manipulate powerful people or cozy up to presidents and judges, but they wanted to be seen as people who were forwarding the cause of abolitionism, of suffragism, even of temperance, which at one time was considered a very progressive cause. So if you look at the claim that the spirit medium was making, and she wrote about this very vividly years later in her memoir, she was encouraging Lincoln through her spirit council to sign the Emancipation Proclamation. That's a very typical story that will come out of spiritualism in a sense. Spiritualism saw itself as this great progressive new faith that was going to knock down walls and help introduce progressive ideas and female liberation into America.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're speaking this hour with Mitch Horowitz about his new book, Occult America. Let's go on the phones first to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I've wondered this for years. What is it about human nature that we crave the miraculous or the fantastic? You know, this spiritualism comes and goes in our culture every generation, and it hits hard, and then it reaches our popular culture and wizards and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, all that stuff. I was wondering if you could sort of speak to, you know, what is it about us that we need this? And it would seem to suggest that, and I'm not trying to step on toes here, that for some of us, just traditional old miracles aren't enough.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, America was certainly a country, and still is a country, where traditional old miracles aren't enough. You know, there was this deep desire in America, and there still is, to be participating in these things in a very current way, to be getting some sort of spiritual counsel or dispensation right here in the present. I mean, the religion of Mormonism, which grew out of the same area of upstate New York where spiritualism was born, it had that as its centerpiece in some ways. Joseph Smith, who was a religious genius, created this New Testament, the Book of Mormon, in which he depicted America as a land of biblical patriarchs, as a place visited by Christ, where a new gospel was delivered. So there was something about the American character that wanted to feel that we were living in a kind of American Israel, that this was the place that the lost tribe had come to, and that there was this new religious dispensation going on here. Oftentimes it sounded a lot like the old religious dispensation, but the claims around it, the claims of the prophets and the messengers, were fantastic. And as far as the impulse behind all this stuff, you know, I mean, it's the same impulse that I think is behind every religious need and expression, every psychological need and expression. We need help. We need invisible help sometimes in this world. You know, people are desperate for answers. In the mid-19th century, not only was there no real therapy or support groups or pastoral counseling, but medical care was often very poor. There was no standard system of medical licensing in this country really until the early 20th century after the founding of Johns Hopkins Medical School. So you had backwoods doctors in this country who were bleeding people with leeches, who were giving people harmful doses of narcotics or mercury. And out of New England comes this movement called the Mental Healing Movement, which was the precursor to Christian Science. And a group of people with mystical ideas, occult and esoteric ideas, started developing this theology that the mind could cure illness, that the seat of illness was in our thoughts, in our attitudes. And oddly enough, for some people, in all truth, this was a safer option than some of what was actually being offered in the examination room, which could be very painful and not in the slightest bit helpful. So you had people not with gullibility or foolishness, but with a needfulness, looking for answers. And they very often turn to arcane and supernatural religious systems for this.
Well, it's so interesting because we see in this the foundation certainly of American exceptionalism and this idea that somehow we are specially blessed as a country.
Yes.
And then there's also this love that we have as Americans for self-help.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, self-help has gone through different phases in this country. I think that the first person, at least here in America, who used the term self-help was probably Ralph Waldo Emerson. That term had been floating around England some years earlier. And Emerson would write these essays, deliver lectures, and, you know, he existed within two worlds. He would insist to people that prayer and religion should not be for private ends. I think he wrote, maybe it was in Self-Reliance, that prayer for a private end is meanness and theft. But at the same time, there was also a more practical Emerson. Since 1859, Emerson had been giving a lecture called Success, and he published this as an essay in 1870. And in Success, he repeated some of these ideas that we shouldn't just turn religion into a kind of hobby horse. But at the same time, he said there are principles, metaphysical principles, that can help one through life. Chief among them is enthusiasm. Life favors enthusiasm, Emerson wrote. So transcendentalist thought could counsel readers and listeners in a very practical way. Be enthusiastic. Don't be gloomy. Don't paint negative pictures. Use your mind. Nothing great was ever accomplished without enthusiasm, Emerson wrote. These things were very arousing to Americans, and obviously they have their higher and lower iterations, but boy, in the mid to late 19th century, we did begin to develop a culture of self-help in this country, therapeutic spirituality, positive thinking, motivational thinking, and once that began to develop, it just traveled into every area of our life. You know, so today, you find self-help therapeutics and spirituality everywhere in America, from New Agers to evangelicals to business seminars. It seems like it's in the groundwater of our country.
want to talk for a minute about the Freemasons, because this is a group that is often viewed from the outside as having a great deal of mysterious, if not sinister, influence over the ways that this country is run. Can you talk first about what you were able to learn about their origins?
Well, Freemasonry, its origins are really shrouded in mystery. Freemasons themselves disagree about where they came from. There is a more conservative view within Freemasonry that says they came out of stoneworking, masonworking guilds of the Middle Ages. Other Masons will talk about connections between Freemasonry and the Knights Templar, which was an order of knights that the Church suppressed just after the Crusades. Some will speak very fancifully of connections to the builders of King Solomon's Temple. There are all kinds of theories and ideas. What I believe, and I think the earliest references to Masonry that are verifiable, is that Masonry was a radical thought movement that came out of the Reformation in the mid-1600s. Masonry was a group of scholars, politicians, businessmen, probably in Scotland and England, who wanted to get together and discuss civic and political and religious ideas free from any church control or intervention. They were very liberal, even radical. They believed in the idea of a spirituality, of a spiritual search that transcended any religion. So they drew very freely upon ancient symbols, obelisks, all-seeing eyes. They drew on symbols that were grisly to some people, skulls and bones and things like that. They were working with a whole wide range of religious ideas, some of them pre-Christian, and they had good reasons in the early days for adopting a stance of secrecy. If you were seen as running afoul of church authorities in the mid-1600s, even in England, you could be arrested or worse. The British philosopher and mathematician John Dee was a religious radical, and after Queen Elizabeth died, he was exiled, even though the Church of England was considered more liberal than the Church of Rome. So you could get yourself in a lot of trouble by experimenting with religious ideas, as Freemasons did in the mid-1600s, and I think they probably had reason to be secretive. That reason is probably gone today. That secrecy is probably kind of old hat today. And Masons, as they spread into the American colonies, I think had a very liberalizing influence on early America. These were people who had principles of religious tolerance, ecumenism, religious liberty. They believed that people of different faiths could function successfully within a single organization or a single country. And you had Freemasons among the American founders, including George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Paul Revere, John Hancock. So this was a very real and very authentic influence in the American colonies. The colonies were being influenced by all kinds of things, and Masonry was most definitely one of them, and it was certainly one of the most liberalizing influences. Now today, in the 21st century, there are more than 1.5 million Freemasons in this country, probably some of them inactive, and I don't think Masonry has any political or religious influence anywhere. They're a fraternal organization, charitable organization. They run a large network of free children's hospitals, and I think probably the presence of radical spiritual ideas or the presence of a real spiritual search within the organization today is very muted.
Mitch Horowitz is my guest. His new book is called Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. Let's go next on the phones to Kelly in Dallas. Hello, Kelly.
Hi.
Hey.
I agree with you on your last comment about the Freemasons. I am one, and it's mostly charity and pretty much free thinking and cult subjects on society. But my question was if you see or have seen any political or cultural influence by modern esoteric or occult organizations such as OTO or the Golden Dawn or the various other small organizations out there, and I will take my question off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you. Very little. You know, people who occupy positions of power are, like everyone else, they're influenced by different things. It is a fact that Ronald and Nancy Reagan were interested in astrology, and quite seriously so. When Ronald Reagan had his first inauguration as governor of California in 1967, he scheduled the inauguration time at 12:10 a.m., and everyone was running around trying to figure out why the governor-elect would want to be inaugurated at such a peculiar time of night. It was because he and Nancy Reagan were consulting an astrologer, a man named Carol Ryder, who was a very popular astrologer in California. He's forgotten today, but In 1969, Carol Reiter was on the cover of Time magazine. He was the first and only astrologer to earn that particular honor. The Reagans were really creatures of California. They were conservative, but they were also Californians through and through. And someone just sent me a speech, actually, where Reagan, while he was president, wrote about the 4th of July, and he repeats a story about some mysterious stranger entering Independence Hall in Philadelphia and encouraging the Founding Fathers to all get together and sign the Declaration of Independence. I think that story is complete fantasy. It appeared in some occult literature in the early 20th century, and somehow it found its way to Reagan's attention. He was probably handed it by somebody, or he may have imbibed some of this literature. You know, the Reagans, again, they were Californians through and through, so certain New Age ideas, certain occult ideas, certainly the idea of astrology, was popular with them. It was a lifelong adult interest. Oftentimes, you'll find these philosophies today existing in the lives and careers of particular individuals. I don't think you find any particular organizations at all of an occult or esoteric bent that have any influence politically today on any kind of a significant scale. People often ask me about the Society of Skull and Bones at Yale, and I don't think there's any civic or spiritual content whatsoever to Skull and Bones so far as I think we can understand it. It's just a networking organization that exists for kind of self-advancement. It has nothing to do with Freemasonry. There's no grand political ideas running through it. There are lots of times in history, including in the Roosevelt administration, the Reagan administration, where you will find individuals who are attracted to these ideas, and those individuals will have influence, and their intellects and their careers may have taken shape under the influence of some pursuit of occult or esoteric spirituality, but it's almost always in the form of an individual interest, not an organizational influence.
Mitch Horowitz is with us this hour. He is editor-in-chief of Tarcher Penguin Publishing. His new book is called Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. If you'd like to join us, send an email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, here with Mitch Horowitz, who is editor-in-chief of Tarcher Penguin. His new book is called Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phones to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey, great program. I don't think you need to look any further to kind of see the links that your guest is making here than our $1 bill. It says "In God We Trust," and then there's that creepy eye on top of the pyramid. What is that eye, and what does it signify? What is it? Is it from one of these, occult beginnings? And does it signify anything in particular? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. I'm glad you brought that up because it is a great story.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, that is one of the most alluring and mysterious images in our national history. The eye in the pyramid is from the reverse of the Great Seal of the United States, which was commissioned by the Continental Congress on July 4th, 1776. And that image, the eye in the pyramid, is an image that was probably influenced by Freemasonry. The image of the pyramid and the all-seeing eye had existed in Masonry for several decades by that point. And people always think it's this kind of scary, mysterious image. I find it a very alluring image, and what it communicates basically is that worldly accomplishment, or the pyramid, is incomplete without some kind of inner vision or inner understanding, or the blessing of providence, as illustrated by the eye hovering above the pyramid. Now, there's a Latin slogan that surrounds the eye in the pyramid that reads, "Annuit coeptis Novos Ordo Seclorum. That can be roughly translated as God smiles on our new order of the ages. Now, people have all these sinister associations with the phrase new order, but in fact, for the founding fathers, the new order of the ages represented a break with the sectarianism of the old world. They felt that this new republic was a place that was going to protect religious liberty and freedom, protect the individual's right to his or her own sense of conscience, that the spiritual search would continue in America as part of a chain of great civilizations going way back to ancient Egypt, up through the pre-Christian civilizations. They believed that they were really striking out to assemble a new society here. And this phrase was filled with idealism. Now, this image of the Iron Pyramid was unknown to most Americans for a great deal of the country's existence because it was only used as a seal for official government business. You didn't really find it anywhere. In the year 1934, this Iron Pyramid caught the attention of members of the Roosevelt administration, in particular a man named Henry A. Wallace, who was Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of Agriculture and later his vice president, preceding Harry Truman. Wallace was a genuine intellectual explorer into occult and esoteric spirituality, and he was very honest about this. He was very upfront about this. He would give speeches in which he would call for the need for a spiritual New Deal. He would talk about the need for a New Deal of the ages. He felt that mankind needed not only to undergo a transformation in its social and civic life, but also in its religious life. We needed a fresh wind to come blowing through the country so that people felt that they could explore religious ideas freely and energetically the way he did. And he brought this symbol, this Iron Pyramid, and this peculiar slogan to the attention of Franklin Roosevelt, who was also a Freemason. And they both got very excited about this. And together they decided this should go on the back of our dollar bill. And sure enough, in the year 1935, it was Franklin Roosevelt who placed the Eye in the Pyramid on the back of our dollar bill. He personally supervised the design and the placement of this Iron Pyramid. In fact, there are surviving handwritten notes of his in the U.S. Treasury Department that show him taking the Iron Pyramid and placing it into a position of primacy on the back of our dollar bill so that when you read the bill from left to right, it's the Iron Pyramid that appears first, which gives people the impression that that is the primary image of our republic rather than the more familiar American Eagle. But in fact, it's the American Eagle that is the front of the Great Seal. But Roosevelt and Henry Wallace were very aroused and turned on by the principles that they thought were conveyed by this Iron Pyramid, because to them, the New Deal was another new order. It was a break with the old world, just as the Founding Fathers felt they were breaking with sectarian Europe. So today, people have all these sinister associations with the Eye in the Pyramid and the idea of a new order, but these things were just expressions of idealism, of hope for a kind of fresh start, both among the Founding Fathers and within the Roosevelt administration. And that, in short, is how the Iron Pyramid got on the back of our dollar bill.
Can you talk for a minute about Ouija boards? Because these, for a time in our history, served a greater function than keeping seventh graders up all night at slumber parties.
That's right. Before Ouija boards became a favorite of pajama parties and basement toy rooms, Ouija was actually a homemade invention among American spiritualists in the 1880s. You find the earliest reference to what might be called a Ouija board in a New York City newspaper in 1886. Back then, they called it the talking board, and it seems to have come to life among enthusiasts of spiritualism in Ohio. These talking boards were alphabet boards that they made at home using a pen knife and maybe an ink brush, and they were used as part of seances. And they would slide this little table around the board, which spiritualists believe was being controlled by some ghostly presence, and spelling out words for them. Now, several years later, some novelty manufacturers in the city of Baltimore managed to patent the talking board, and in 1891, they trademarked it as the Ouija board, and they began to market it all over the country as a toy, as a board game, and it just took off. And by the mid-1960s, the patent was bought by the toy company Parker Brothers, and when they marketed Ouija, there was one year where it actually outsold Monopoly, the most popular board game in America. But what it is it's a homemade object from spiritualism that probably has become the most enduring mechanism or device of spiritualism. And everyone of a certain generation seems to have a scary Ouija story.
We have an email here from Angela who writes, my grandmother, great aunt, great grandmother, and great great grandmother were all spiritualists. At funerals, there was always a spiritualist minister and a Lutheran minister. Both would give a service. I found many documents about their activities, but cannot find any information in the library or the web. My great aunt even went to a spiritualist summer camp, and my grandmother was married with a spiritual minister and a Lutheran minister. Is that typical? Have you heard stories like that?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, there still is a national spiritualist church in this country, a council of spiritualist churches. They regard themselves as Christian churches, but they have this spiritualist wrinkle in which spirit mediums will participate in the service, and people are supposed to be able to communicate with departed loved ones or beings in the afterlife. Spiritualism really conducted itself as a religion in this country by the mid to late 19th century. You had a very wide network of spiritualist newspapers, spiritualist churches that indeed considered themselves Christian. A number of these places are still in existence today. Probably the oldest one is in the city of Boston. And as she was alluding in her email, you had spiritualist summer camps, spiritualist Sunday schools. Here in New York City, where I live, there were spiritualist Christian Sunday schools for children. They would learn Bible catechism, and they would learn spiritualism. In Wisconsin, in Florida, in upstate New York, you had spiritualist summer camps that were not just places for kids, but were places for grown-ups. People would spend the whole summer at these vacation colonies and camps, and they would. And some of these still exist. There's one still existing near Buffalo, New York. There's another one in Florida. They're smaller places, but it just gives you a sense that, you know, spiritualism was really organized as a religion and as a civic organization in this country. And for a period of time, particularly in the latter half of the 19th century, it was very popular, and you can still find these vestiges.
Was there always a sort of countervailing tradition of debunkers throughout this spiritualist history of the United States?
It really, that tradition of debunking, I mean, obviously there were always people who thought this was all a bunch of hoo-ha. I mean, it's not that everybody was on board with this, and there were plenty of skeptics from the very beginning. The march of skepticism got ratcheted up in the 1870s. There was a reformist congressman named Robert Dale Owen, who had been a close friend and confidant of Abraham Lincoln's. And Owen, who was a very highly respected figure in society, he sat through a number of seances in which he was visited by the presence of a female spirit named Katie King. And this was actually physically embodied spirit, as Owen and his fellow onlookers experienced it. And in 1875, Owen wrote an article for the Atlantic magazine. It was an installment in his memoirs, and in this article in the Atlantic magazine, he defended spiritualism, and he wrote about these physical manifestations of this spirit named Katie King. And just as the article was going to press, he discovered that Katie King was an actress and that he was being hoodwinked, and he felt very much like a sad, lonely old man who was being fooled and manipulated by this spiritualist couple and this actress who played the role of the spirit. It all seems so obvious to us today, but back then people were very hungry for contact and for belief, and for Owen this was a real downfall because the article had already gone to press and the Atlantic had to slip in an errata slip saying, well, it so happens that Congressman Owen thinks this story might not be true after all. And he actually was committed briefly to a sanitarium after that. He was so depressed and it so broke him. Really at that time, spiritualism's prestige and its fortunes began to decline.
Let's go next to Ryan in Grapevine. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I've just got a question regarding the Bohemian Grove Group. I understand it's meant to be comprised of former statesmen and captains of industry, but they, you know, from things you heard from people like Alex Jones, they have some kind of strange occult rituals like the cremation of care, and people like Alex Jones and other people seem to think they have some sinister plot to overthrow the rest of the world.
Are you familiar with the organization, Mitch?
You know, to the extent that I have been asked about it on a few occasions, I mean, people are there's a notion that circulates on the internet and elsewhere that there is a group of political and commercial elites who form this Bohemian Grove group, and they engage, as the gentleman was saying, in various occult rituals. I don't know a great deal about it. It has the fingerprints of the kind of story that has circulated a lot within American folklore. I don't think that's what's going on. You know, I think that people, I'll put it to you this way. People have developed suspicions over Freemasonry, and those suspicions kind of branch out into other directions, and there is a kind of a folklore that's developed around groups like Skull and Bones or Bohemian Grove, that there are groups of elite practicing these dark ceremonies. The fact is, in this country, after Freemasonry helped introduce a lot of very liberal American values into the colonies, there was a period in the early 1900s, specifically in the 1820s, where a murder occurred in upstate New York, and there was suspicion that Freemasonic zealots were behind this murder. There was an ex-Mason who was preparing to publish a manuscript that was supposed to reveal some of Masonry's secrets, and he was harassed, and he was murdered. His name was William Morgan, and he was presumed killed at the hands of Freemasonry. And after that, the public, for a period of time, grew very suspicious of Masonic influence in the courts and law enforcement. There was never a satisfying legal investigation of this gentleman's murder. And a wave of anti-Masonry started to sweep the country in the late 1820s. There were anti-Masonic newspapers. There were anti-Masonic political parties and politicians who really ran on an anti-Masonic plank. And people were concerned with corruption in high places. They were concerned that Masonry as a fraternity had an undue influence on the courts and in law enforcement. And there may have been pockets of the country where that was true. And those concerns turned into a very angry anti-Masonic movement. Eventually, the waters calmed, and the anti-Masonic movement kind of ebbed. But Masonry's prestige was never the same in American life again. It could still command the loyalty of certain politicians, presidents, captains of industry, but its prestige as an organization never recovered. And I think coming out of that particular period in American history, people developed a number of fearful associations and concerns, not only over Masonry, but other secretive occult-like organizations. I think that to a very great extent, that is fantasy and folklore. I think it's a legacy of the anti-Masonic movement that sprang up in this country in the 1820s.
Mitch, you've done so much writing on a subject that would strike me as more difficult than some others that you might have chosen as a field of study to verify. Can you talk in the last 30 seconds or so that we have about whether or not you think it's more difficult to sort of get to the truth about the founding of these organizations and about the people who were influential within them?
Oh, that's a great question. I made a tremendous effort in the book to always try to verify and corroborate things using sources that people could go to themselves. I tried to use the tools every bit of a mainstream historian in the book because many of the records are fuzzy. These organizations very often existed on the fringes of American life, even though they were very influential within mainstream American life. And there was a standard of record keeping, and there were claims that were sometimes lax, that were sometimes imaginary. So when you're writing about fantastical subject matter, you really do have to double your efforts to sit down and lay your hands on records that are verifiable, that can be corroborated. So I made every effort I could in this book to really come to use mainstream tools to write about fantastic subjects.
The new book by Mitch Horowitz is called Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. I'll never get this out. Mitch, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.